Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Sales Effectiveness Radio, brought to you by the Semantics Group. Now here's your host, Steve Maul.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. This is Steve Maul in the Lazy, Crazy, Hazy Day of Summer episode, coming at you from Atlanta, Georgia, with Sales Effectiveness Radio. And we're going to do the show a little bit differently this week. I was at a conference last week, and in the studio with me, I got Lee Cantor, my studio-based wingman, and we have a guest coming on the show in just a little bit. But I was at a conference last week and doing a little talk, and one of the questions came up that said, you know, why do training implementations fail? Why do we spend the money on a training implementation, come back a few months later, and everything seems kind of the same way it used to be? And it got me to thinking, you know, there's a long list of things that are probably involved in that. But it got me thinking about how that's something from a sales effectiveness perspective we really should dig into a little bit more. And I'll probably publish a white paper on this coming up. But it seemed like it's worth mentioning that there's some very predictable things that organizations should look at in preparing for any kind of skill building or process improvement or methodology implementation or anything that's going to be focused on effectiveness of a particular audience that really needs to be taken into consideration before that implementation starts, while it's underway, and afterwards, because it doesn't happen by magic. And I've been doing this for almost 40 years now, and I've never once had any organization suddenly become a new person or new group of people simply because they attended a three-day workshop. And so it's that awareness, and I think everybody has that awareness, but a lot of faith gets put into, did we pick the right methodology, or did we have the right training? And, you know, it's one of those things where a lot of people might argue that a professional services or a selling methodology, anyone is as good as the next. And while I don't believe that's true in an absolute sense, for some organizations, one could work equally as well as any other one they pick. It really comes down to commitment and execution. So I thought I would just take a few moments at the beginning of the show to talk about really those three time frames I just mentioned. The things to do in advance of the quote-unquote training, and you can't see me because this is radio, but I'm making air quotes because training means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But if we stop and think about what it means to upskill or do talent development with a professional audience, we know that they walk in with a preconceived notion of how to do their job already and where their own weaknesses are. And that attitude in and of itself and that knowledge set in and of itself can have a lot to do with their acceptance of or willingness to absorb any of the content that's being delivered to them. So I just wanted to highlight a few things for you as the audience to think about as you begin to think about driving lasting change into your organization, lasting improvement. And prior to any of these initiatives, whether they be training or methodology or talent development, or you pick the name, but prior to any of those, the things that will cause it to fail before it's ever been deployed is, first, a lack of true executive sponsorship. And that means that it's more than lip service. It's more than just saying, yeah, I want to do this, or yeah, we need a new methodology. From the executive perspective, they got to get on board and show true leadership. They got to be able to create the vision of where the organization is going. They have to be able to walk the walk, not just talk the talk, of how that new process will be followed, what they expect from it, how they're going to measure it, how they expect you to perform as part of their team, and how they're going to perform in order to support that. The second area that they really need to focus on is integration to what's already in place and what's already working. I with all the clients I work with day in and day out and have over the years, I've never walked into one where nothing worked. They've all got something that works to some extent. And so it's one of those things that if the organization who's delivering the training comes in with this off-the-shelf program, where, you know, it's been delivered to thousands of people or tens of thousands of people before. That's all well and good. But unless it's been delivered to 10,000 people who are in the exact same situation that this organization's in, then you're going to have friction points or gaps. And if you don't pay enough attention to that, you're setting up the learners and the participants in that program for failure, because good enough doesn't work. And it's one of those things where they won't self-cure. You can't leave the interpretation of a terminology or a nomenclature conflict to the participants in the room to figure out. You got to understand where all of those touch points are, where the overlaps are, where the gaps will be, so that you can really do that translation for them in advance of delivery. And so to those organizations who deliver off the shelf, and there's a lot of them out there, and there's a lot of really good stuff, customization has to be more than putting the client's name on the front of the book. It really does take an additional level of effort. The third thing prior is to any kind of deployment is inadequate engagement of frontline managers. These are the people who make this happen. These are the men and women in your organization who are going to be on the front lines all the time, talking to the sales professionals, coaching them, inspecting their work, giving guidance. And if they don't know with integral intimacy, the inner workings of what you're about to train their team with, then you're disarming them in the war towards effectiveness. So I really encourage those people who are looking at programs to think about those things in advance. Now, there's a lot of things during deployment as you're beginning to do the training and rolling it out that just make common sense. Like, let's not try to boil the ocean. Let's not try to solve every problem all at once. Let's build training content that's as simple as it can be and still be true to purpose. It's got to be relevant. I just see too many out there that are one size fits all, and the lack of relevance means you're inviting the participants to ignore it. Training that's not real life, you know, asking a learner to practice a skill in a way that's different than they would in their normal course of work, is frustrating to them and unproductive in a general sense. Instruction that is focused too much on the what and the how instead of the why really, is suboptimal. Like Simon Sinek says, always begin with why. Why is it important they learn a particular skill? Because if they don't understand the rationale, if they don't understand the value delivered by that particular skill or talent area, the adoption level goes down pretty dramatically. The other thing I'll just mention in the during deployment area is the facilitators who are not practitioners. I've just seen too many where, you know, I know I've been certified as an instructor and therefore you should listen to me, type of training programs where if you can't deal with the questions from the audience about how it actually gets applied and what if this one thing happens that isn't what you mentioned in your program, and that falls apart pretty quickly. So practitioners who choose to train and coach have a valuable gift to people. And it's better that you take advantage of those types of individuals than somebody who has, quote unquote, again, my air quotes, book smarts on a particular topic. Last thing I'll mention is just the post-training. What happens after the program's done? And, you know, we talked about getting managers involved up front. Well, if you did that and then they fail to coach those new techniques and skills, you've wasted your money. I always talk about the fact that a manager's job, sales managers in particular, and the percentage could be a little different on the professional services side. But if you're in a customer facing organization and you're part of the sales team, I expect sales managers to be coaching about 50% of their day. Now, that doesn't mean deal inspection or account reviews or call plan reviews. It does include those, but that's not the only type of coaching I expect a sales manager would do. And so if they're spending more than 50% of their time in bureaucracy and administration and report generation and upward delegation and upward expectation management, then you're suboptimizing the potential of your sellers. And the reason you have sales managers is not to boss your salespeople. It's to guide them. It's to help them. It's to knock hurdles down for them. So they are the true sales enablers, like everybody else in your organization should be sales enablement. That's a culture, not a job description. And so a sales manager who isn't coaching, isn't spending time with his or her reps, can't do that effectively. The couple other things to think about after the fact is that ongoing cross-pollination with other processes, because almost any customer-facing process, whether it's sales or consulting or marketing, customer service, have touch points to one another. And those integration points are critical, because nothing frustrates a customer more than to have just closed a sales cycle and then be met by the professional services team that says, now, what did you buy? Or what? Oh, they told you it would do that. Oh no, it doesn't do that. So that in those integration points, the timing and the efforts towards those become imperative. Because think about it: at the end of the day, your enablement and your sales effectiveness is driven largely by the customer's perception of the experience they just had. And If your goal is to get salespeople to sell better, then you need to focus on helping them customers buy better, getting them to help customers buy better. And that means making it as easy as possible to buy from you and making the experience with your organization as seamless as is humanly possible. The last thing I'll just mention here, and there's many more, but the thing that I want everybody to listen to about is that developing of champions and internal instructors, especially if you've bought training from someone else, you know, that training vendor, because I am one, would love to have you spend money with them forever. That's not the best approach for you to have in order to develop a sustainable program in your organization. Matter of fact, I told a client this morning, I said, my job is not to move in here and never go home. I want to come back a lot and get more money from you every time I do it, but I don't want to live here. I don't want to undertake sales management's responsibilities. And so beware the training provider who does want to do that. Beware the goal or the lack of having internally certified people who know the process or the skill or the technique inside out, so they can build job aids for your salespeople, so they can coach those salespeople, so they can build content around it, so they can help marketing deliver competitive information in a way that's already to be consumed by the salespeople in the delivery of those messages they give to your customers and prospects. The cohesive nature of that talent development is possible. It does take some time and energy, but one of the reasons, because this goes back to the reason this question came up, is why do these things fail? Why do we, 2 years after putting in one sales methodology, decide that didn't work, so let's try another? Because I'll promise you this, unless you change the things I just discussed, this one won't work either.
Now, when you're kind of planning these kind of initiatives, there's obviously some pain that's precipitated this kind of effort, right? Isn't it at the heart of all of this is the culture of the organization to really embrace kind of this level of change that's about to occur and really look at it holistically and not, like you said, a bolt-on where they're just saying, hey, look, we got a problem in this area. Let's buy this program and this is going to solve that. And then good luck, everybody. You know, we believe it because I read the book and the guy's smart. And then so, you know, I made all of my kind of C-suite read the book and we're all said, yeah, this is something. So they're kind of giving lip service to senior leadership buy-in, but they're really not getting at the heart of the why they're going to take on this kind of initiative.
Well said. The underlying, I don't generally use the word pain, but I understand why people do. So I always think about what's broken in the organization. What doesn't work as well as we want it to? Because my favorite saying, and I say this right to clients, I say, you know, you can tell me what you need or you want or what your requirements are. And I do care, but not that much. Because when you tell me a need or a want or a requirement, you've presumed what the solution is, and you're assessing my ability to deliver what you're asking for.
Right.
And so what I really want to know is what's broken, what doesn't work in your organization, or what can't your team do that you would like them to be able to do. So that's a missing element. And there's two aspects of that. So those challenges, missing or broken, if they're having impact to the business, revenue decline, revenue growth slowing, cost of sales, selling expense too high, too much turnover, too onboarding's taking too long, those are impacts to the business that now become quantifiable and start to build the value message into that. Because if you don't have the anticipated results in mind, then you're doing it all about hope. Oh, I read this great book. Yeah, the guy's really smart, and I think it would be a great program. Storytelling would be something we should definitely do here because I read a great book on storytelling. But if I don't understand why storytelling matters to me generating more business, either leads or closing rates or speed, velocity in the pipeline, the value is all ephemeral. It can't be measured. Or at least not with a tie back, a cause and effect relationship to the technique I've just put in there.
So, and then some of it is tactics. Like, these are all great tactics, but how are you going to the person that's already killing it in the organization? Go, you know what? We're doing storytelling now, and I know you don't do storytelling. Your thing is totally different, but now we need you to be doing more storytelling.
Yeah, so the Clone Wars, right? So I have to have everybody be in lockstep with one another. And I think that's a really risky and somewhat illogical approach. If somebody's already killing it, you say, go with God, keep killing
exactly.
it. And don't worry about storytelling. Now, if you start stumbling, I'm going to come back and say, what can we do to help you? But to try and implement a process on top of top performers is insane. So you don't fix what's not broken. Fix the things that are broken. And if somebody gets their feelings hurt because I have to go to training and he doesn't have to, get over it. You know, buck up.
When you have her numbers, you don't have to go anymore.
Exactly. and so that you talked about company culture and it's company culture and sales culture, because what we see a lot is what I call a tolerating mediocrity. And I see that in a lot of business today where good enough is okay. You know, I'm not going to hold everybody's feet to the fire. And I think that does a disservice to the selling profession in many ways. But more importantly, it's costing organizations more than it needs to develop the revenue results they're doing. Now, I'm not in favor of, you know, a militaristic, boot camp kind of selling culture where we all have to get up at 5 o'clock and do calisthenics. Cause if you've seen me, you know, I don't do calisthenics, but it's one of those things where you got to have a sense of responsibility, which is the internal feeling that people have about wanting to do their job right, and accountability, which is the company's or the organization's expectation of what they want you to do.
But then how do you scale something? How about if you're trying to build this model and you go, okay, look, she's killing it, he's killing it, these people are underperforming in my mind because other people are doing it, but I want to make this system work in 50 states, not just in Oregon.
Right. So you have to you need to assess whether the reason those outliers are killing it is something that can be reproduced, because some people have certain skill sets and talent areas that you're not going to reproduce. They have a natural ability or a particularly large book of business. They have a long-standing relationship that you can't just pick up and translate that to somebody else. So you have to do a real analysis of what the process or skill problem is.
So then my training initiative might fail if I have just some natural born salespeople?
No, what I'm saying is you have to pick the right sales training. So if I look at, let's go back to the example you talked about. You know, I've got two or three people who are killing it and they do tell stories. Mm-hmm. It would be wrong to interpolate that what I need to do is teach everybody storytelling, because that may not be their magic, their secret sauce.
Right.
Right. It's an error to just assume that the one or two things that you see them doing differently is the real reason they're as successful as they are.
But then how am I choosing the right training initiative that's going
to
work?
You have to do an assessment. You got to do an evaluation of the sales force and look at the skills and
talent.
But
is that me or is it the consultant I'm hiring?
It's usually the consultant, because you want somebody with objectivity. So you might look at the doing an evaluation and looking at the talents and skills against, you know, there are standard competencies out there that you're looking for, and there are standard evaluation tools you can use. But the key there is then ranking those and assigning those. I'm a big fan of tailoring the learning experience based upon what your gaps are. So to make everybody go do an objection handling course, if they're already good at objection handling,
right, silly.
Is ridiculous. It's a waste of their time. They resist and you lose right. credibility. Same thing with closing skills. Same thing with hunting or prospecting, you know, question development, competitive traps, all those sorts of things. So you test them on where they're good at and you focus their development effort on the things they're not.
But you customize that to each of the salespeople.
Yes. Now you don't do one-on-one training, but you set up learning experiences that if you're in the cohort of people who need to do better probing during a discovery call, you're going to attend that.
Right. And then so you customize it to wherever the gaps are and where the improvement needs are, and then you implement something that's simple, relevant, real life by somebody that's a practitioner, so they're teaching it properly.
And so they know right. BS because, you know.
Right. They can call them on it.
Right. Because you might do something exactly the way I described it, but it really doesn't have any practical validity. Right. And so you need to go, would you really say that to a customer? Right. And if they say, yeah, I go, great. Now let me role play that with you. And you can test it real time.
And then the room can kind of judge if it's real life or not.
That's right? Exactly right.
And then, so then you do that and then you enable the sales, kind of the sales managers to be the coach and spend their time being the yes. coach rather than the administrator.
Yeah. And like when we do that at the Semantics Group, what I do is if they say we need you to come in and help us on the coaching as well, I say, great. What we're going to do is we're going to listen in on the coaching conversations you're having with your people
right now.
And then we're going to coach your managers.
So that way you're not coming in to save the day as super coach.
That's right. So we'll either listen live or sometimes if it's remote, they'll record the call and we'll listen to it and we can give feedback as to, geez, there was a missed opportunity to challenge that or you didn't dig in on this particular answer that might have given you better insight as to how well they actually did advance the sale at this particular thing. Because the typical response when you come back, and I'm probably oversimplifying this, but too many times, you know, you come back from a sales call and your manager goes, how'd it go? And you go, two great. Thumbs up. Great.
they love me.
And they say, fantastic. Let me know if you need anything else.
Right. We're done.
Which is not a call debrief, right? I'd like to know why did it go great? Right. Go great. What did you accomplish? How did you hit your objectives? What are the next steps?
Right.
Who was there? What did they say? What questions did they ask? You know, that's a call debrief that allows you to coach. Mm-hmm. And I get it. I mean, people are busy and we continue. I've said this on the show before. Corporate America is in the do more with less mentality and we've cut all the fat we can and we're well into flesh approaching bone. I mean, you can only cut so deep on people's time and your budgets. You have to look for revenue growth if you want to survive. Right. It's not just an expense reduction game.
And it's hard to coach by checklist, right?
Right. So, and you can have a thing, a checklist of the things I want to know, but the conversation has to be much more natural.
Because there's layers.
It has to be organic. It's
not like, you know, these ABC, 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 and, you know, there were 14 Bs, so then they're this. Like, it's a human-to-human interaction.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, you know, your listeners to the show may remember an interview I did with the guys from Refract. Back in March or April, I can't remember which one, but where they talked about having automated coaching platform and that doesn't coach automatically, but what it does is automatically capture the conversation right. so that coaching can happen. So it measures who's doing most of the talking in a customer salesperson conversation. How often does the conversation switch between salesperson and customer? How many questions do you ask? Cause it can tell through intonation at the end of a sentence, whether it's an interrogatory or a statement. So you can do keyword search on the transcript to find the things that you want to listen for. That kind of tool set will help a manager be much more effective. But in any way, one way or another, you can't just coach without observation. So I'm not a big fan of ride-alongs because people don't behave the same when their manager's in the car with them or in right. the room with them. But the post-call coaching is an absolute must.
And then, but that requires some skill in terms of asking the right questions and doing and listening the right way.
Right. And there are some phenomenal sales managers out there who are doing a great job. Mm-hmm. And what I always try to do, like I said in the session is, or in the, my intro is look at what's already working and leverage the hell out of it. So talk to the managers who are already really, really good. Replicate their behavior to the extent that you can. Map it back to the sales culture and the company culture, so that it feels like it comes from them, not from the outside organization.
That's right. It's organic.
Very organic.
And it's not just kind of, we just bolted this on.
Right.
Cool. Good stuff. So you're writing a book about that?
I don't know if it'll be a book. You know, I have a book in me, but I don't know if it'll ever get out.
At least an infographic. It'll be an infographic.
Yeah, we can definitely get an infographic.
So who'd you bring with you today?
Well, I am really pleased. I got Phil Bush with me today, and Phil is a sales enablement and sales effectiveness expert in the field. Phil comes from Maverin Sales and Marketing and has, you know, more than 15 years of doing just what we've talked about today. You know, in addition to a selling career himself, Phil has spent 15 years focused on helping develop the right kind of behaviors and practices within organizations, particularly around sales team coordination, partner execution, worked at IBM, worked at Oracle, worked at Infor, and other both large and small companies. Phil, very much glad to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Very happy to be here, and I think you guys hit on so much great stuff. I'm not sure what else I'm going to say.
Oh, I'm sure you got something to say.
You usually have some opinions.
Well, I have a few, yeah. But no, I think you guys really, I think that was a really great encapsulation of many of the things that we see out there right now, for sure.
What are some of the other challenges you do run into?
Well, you hit on them. I may say them a little differently,
sure.
But the biggest thing that I see is what I refer to as the shiny new object syndrome. And that is, you put a methodology in, it's the latest shiny new object, and this is going to solve all of our problems.
So the silver bullet shiny object.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
And I have seen that repeatedly. And number one, as you indicated, that's not the trick at all. Number two, are you really evaluating it based on your situation, or is it just the latest shiny new object that you happen to stick in? And unfortunately, it almost comes down to, you know, sometimes a new manager comes in or a new sales exec, and they're the shiny new object.
So they came in and say, well, when I was at XYZ, we used to do it this way. Right. And, you know, because they're the new guy, you want to give them, you don't want to be too constraining on what you let them do. So,
right.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, absolutely. And
now, what do you think's at the heart of that, though? If you see it time and time again,
yeah,
it's not like you see it occasionally. It happens over and over.
Is it
some element of fear of missing out that the existing company, the incumbent, thinks, well, I didn't know about that, or maybe this person has some magic, or they have some belief that there's some magic solution out there?
Well, I mean, there are no silver bullets, just to
right.
be very clear.
But everybody can say that intellectually, but then a new guy's going to come on with some thing, and you'll be like, well, that's worth a try. Like at some point, you know, you're kind of hoping it's true.
Well, you're hoping it's true, but the reality of it is very rarely is it true. And Steve mentioned this in you know, earlier, but you know, there are many different methodologies and processes out there, and that's all well and good. But it comes down, and Steve, also, you guys talked a little bit about this, but the notion of evaluating it based on your company, your culture, your existing business processes. Are we doing that, or are we just giving it lip service?
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people give it lip service. I really do.
So they don't want to kind of do the work and the kind of I know you don't like to use the word pain, but they don't want to go through that, you know, if they can help it.
Oh, pain's a real thing. It just doesn't work in selling.
Yeah.
You can have pain. I just don't. There's one thing that, and I don't know the psychological term for this, but, when you make a decision, you look for ways to validate it, and you don't want to put yourself in risk of having it refuted before your very eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you hire a new sales executive, and all of a sudden he or she wants to do this or that, and you go, geez, I don't really think that's the answer. You're less likely to resist that because you want that new hire you just made to be successful.
Yes.
And you don't want the risk of alienating somebody you just brought on board. So I think there's, like I said, I don't know the psychological term for that, but I'm sure there is one.
There is one, I'm sure, too.
But shouldn't you have gotten to that before you hired them?
Oh, you, oh, you dreamer, you. Yes, you should have.
That could be a whole separate show. Right? That won't be a problem to have a whole separate show about the proper hiring.
Why hiring fails.
Oh, maybe. Boy. Well, the whole notion of challenges, though, that's one for sure. The second one is, you know, I always look at every methodology, whatever it's called, and there are many out there. Many books have been written, and I've read some of them, and I go, this is the same as that one, just with different words attached, but that's just me. But I always look at it from three perspectives about every seller. Are they working and do they understand how to build a relationship? Now, that's different for every organization. I'm the first to admit that, but that everyone's got to have a standard within the company of what it takes. Secondly, is there an effective and easy to follow roadmap to revenue? Because again, if there's not, what are we doing here, really? What are we accomplishing? Oh, that person likes me and that person likes... No, this is not Barney, folks. I like you. I do like right, me. It's not the
answer. We played golf three times.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I've heard that one. And the third one is the customer going to be successful using this product or service?
Yeah.
And I always look at those three things and say, if we're not checking all three of those boxes, we've got a problem here.
So one of the things, the roadmap to revenue thing that you just brought up, I see that all the time. It'd be wonderful to spend a couple more minutes on that because most every methodology has a mechanism for mapping relationships or time spent or degree of trust established or their degree of influence. And some of those are enormously powerful and well-founded, but there's not I'm not sure there's a 100% connection between the number of people you have established a solid relationship with and the degree of revenue that gets produced. And be really great to kind of understand how the measurement of relationships flows into that pathway to revenue. Have you given that any thought?
I have, and here's what I find. One of the things about sellers, especially going back to what you said earlier about coaching, are we coaching our sellers or are we just basically mastering the spreadsheet world? Which some managers, unfortunately, they are masters of the spreadsheet. Now, they may be really good at that, but that isn't coaching.
And in that case, the spreadsheet's the forecast, the pipeline. Okay.
That's it. But going back to the nature of this, when you look at relationships within a sales process, are we, one of the things we see sellers say, and going back to what you said earlier, I had a great meeting. That's nice. And right. And what do we get out of that meeting? Did we get a next step or a set of steps?
Right.
And what is the roadmap to revenue? Now, I have asked sellers and sales managers that question repeatedly, and most often I get the look like a dog, like, what?
Yeah.
Well, because that roadmap is the path to the revenue, right?
It
right.
is.
And so if you're on step three and you got to get to step six.
Yeah.
And if that meeting was great and you had a great time and everything there, but we're still on step three, I don't know if that was a great meeting.
That's exactly right. Well said. And I always tell people, you know, lay out the steps for me. And I'm not saying you've got to get them all in one meeting. That's not the point. But you've got to be able to lay out in your own mind first.
Exactly. If you can't do it there, you're never going to do it in real life.
You can't do it in real life.
Right, but
exactly right.
But it's not just the steps you want to take. It's the steps the customer needs to
have to take in order to buy.
And the resources they commit. And when I talk about resources, it's people and access and time.
Absolutely.
And mapping that out in a way that looks very clearly as though it's to their benefit, because in real life it should be.
It should be.
Yes.
But it also, what most people think about that and is that it's just a checkpoint. It's a measurement mechanism. And what they fail sometimes to realize is that it's a tool to actually drive customer behavior.
Well, you're absolutely right, Steve. And I actually, what I have done with many of my clients, I have broken. I don't know what their word is. I can't even speak today. Jeez. I have tried to break them of the habit of using this tool that they think is a tool called a close plan.
Right.
And I have desperately tried to break that behavior and replace it with something that it talks to what you just said. It's the buying and selling habits and processes.
Right.
And I refer to, and I have my own name for it. I'm sure there's many names. I call it a timeline to go live. It's not just about the sale. It's about getting to the sale, yes, but then getting them live with what they have bought.
Right.
And I want to have the whole process mapped out.
Right, through the outcome they desire.
Exactly. So, what they pay money for.
Which includes measuring the results. because that's how they determine whether or not it was a good decision.
Exactly.
Right? And I love the fact that you've taken it into implementation and go live, because we know that there's a lot of salespeople out there and some who are listening to this program who, once the deal is done, their responsibility is kind of over. And,
right.
And I get that. I genuinely do. That's what they're paid to do. But it's how it gets transitioned and who's picking up the ball and how that continues to use the momentum of the sales process into the implementation and go live.
Right.
That's an important thing.
It is a very important thing.
And it's important to consider that, you know, in their mind, they think they're done at the selling part. And if it's not a good fit, then maybe they didn't do a great job in the selling. They picked the wrong customer. And
yeah,
so that,
yeah,
you know, if it doesn't
holistically
fit into the kind of the goal and strategy of the organization, just
right.
because you're good at selling something to somebody who doesn't need it and you're getting compensated well, that isn't helping really in the long run for anybody.
It doesn't. You're absolutely right. And on top of that, what's really interesting about it is, in many situations, what about the next sale?
Right.
Are we going to be able to sell something else?
Right.
To
Are
this
we going
person?
To cross sell in there? Or are we going to do all these other things?
If you fail on the first sale, when the next opportunity comes along, you're starting from ground zero. Actually, you're starting from
less
position
than
negative
zero.
10.
Right.
Negative.
But the salesperson might think everything's great and it's working
right.
for them.
Whereas if you are successful, the next time there's an opportunity, you're starting at plus 20.
Right.
right. But that's defining success a little differently than
right.
they might
it
be
is.
Defining
right.
it.
Well, and that's what I work with clients on, because it is and Steve, you hit on it very well about people put in the methodology. I happen to call it a shiny object, but
sure.
you know, yeah. whatever it is. And they think this is going to be the key to success. It's not.
Right.
But the other thing that, you know, what I find that is working is what you talked about very well, the tailoring of training, the tailoring of process based on who you are working with.
Right.
And when you try to do it a one size fits all, I have very rarely, if ever, seen that do anything except cause pain to the organization.
Yeah. And by the way, that actually then lessens the credibility of sales leadership.
Oh, yeah.
Because when they come back 2 years later and have to do something else, the sales force is all going SSDD. Same
yeah.
stuff, different day.
Yes.
Exactly.
And going back to that timeline to go live, the thing to remember there is that when you've closed the deal, the salesperson may think, glad that's done. The customer's going, what do you mean? We're just getting started.
Right, exactly.
All that crap I went through to get to,
right,
this,
to get
point,
to this point.
That's
were,
their day one.
That, yeah, those were table stakes to get
yes,
to this point.
Right.
And my future lies before me. And you're telling me bye-bye, here's somebody else?
Right.
Yeah. That whole management. And I get it. I'm not trying to change the org structure of a company to say that the salesperson has to manage the implementation, but the management of those introductions and the
yeah.
transference of trust.
Yes.
And the things that drive relationships between yourselves and the buyers are critical.
Yeah.
And I think it was last show or maybe two shows ago, Scott Sullivan was in here and Scott talked about managing relationships inside the business is equally important to managing those outside.
Yes.
When you come back from that sales call, making sure everybody, whether it's the product team, support team, pre-sales, manager, everybody else understood what was going on as well so that they were ready to help sell.
Right.
And I thought that was a brilliant way to extend the relationship
mm-hmm.
notion
oh, yeah.
to the stuff that Phil's talking about as well.
And yeah. that's the stuff that provides more value to the client that's going to keep them around and where you have these other opportunities bubbling.
Yes. Right. Because if you don't do that, the client will find somebody else to buy from pretty darn quickly,
exactly.
in my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll find them, and it won't take very long.
Right.
Well, yeah, there's very few people out there that – I mean, it always depends upon the cost of change. But we all have met people that it didn't matter what it cost. They wanted to change badly enough
right.
that the cost was overcome. So.
Yeah. Yeah, they will. It will get overcome, because one of the things that – you know, one of the things that salespeople are always quizzed on by sales management, and I know we've all seen this, is, well, do they have a budget for this?
Right.
I mean, that's the standard classic question.
Right.
And what I always like to say to that answer is, if a salesperson, A, they may not know it, but if they are really worried about a budget, are they talking to the right people in the first place?
Right.
And the answer is usually not so much.
Because if you're talking to somebody who has to rely upon budget availability, your price, you've already got your price point.
That's
and
it.
So there's always somebody in an organization who can spend off budget.
That's right.
The only exception to that being public sector. But if you're in a commercial enterprise, there's somebody who can spend beyond the budget.
That's exactly right, Steve. And I think that's a key point. So a lot of the things we're talking about comes from the fact that, you and I have been doing this for a very long time, working with people who have been down these paths, and they haven't really understood that, you know, replacing one object with another doesn't do the trick. And meaningful change is just that. It's meaningful change. And within the context of what you said about being within the company culture, and right. sales process has to be echo the company culture, and vice versa, I might add.
Yeah, I agree.
If it doesn't, what are we doing here?
Yeah, if there's a mismatch between selling culture and company culture, it's going to be pretty evident when you walk in the door.
Boy.
But let me change the focus just for a moment. Have you seen anything that's working particularly well?
Yeah.
Any breakthroughs that you've witnessed organizations take?
I have seen a few. But they typically come about, a couple of caveats to what I'm about to say. To what you said earlier, if senior management will not stand up and say, this is my program.
Yeah.
It can't be a sales program. It's got to be the senior, it's got to be the company program, and senior management is on board, and they are actively on board, not just giving lip service and saying, go talk to the salespeople.
Right.
That's the first thing. But what happens when it works because of that first. And secondly, it works because in most cases, the sales force has been analyzed, typically by an outside consultant, to understand, what do we have today?
Right.
Do we really understand what we got? Because I have found more than one organization that thinks, oh, yeah, we've got a sales force of X. And you ask them questions about their makeup. Many of the people inside the company, they don't really know it. Oh, well, they were a very successful seller over here. I'm like, well, that's nice. What is their makeup? What is their background? What are their beliefs? What are the things that they believe about selling in the first place?
Right.
We haven't done that. So when it works, it's because people like yourself, like me, come in and analyze, what are we dealing with here?
And that's why I like using when I do an assessment, it differentiates talent, which is the stuff inside of you.
Yes.
From skills.
Oh, yeah.
Which I can develop.
Yes.
And I can develop talent, but you have to really want to develop it, and it takes a lot longer.
Oh, it does.
So whether it's your belief system, whether it's your outlook, how you're motivated, taking comfort discussing money, things like that, all those things can be taught, but they take a lot longer because they take an internal motivation. But if you want to know how to do hunting or closing or presentation, I can teach you that stuff because that's technique.
It's technique.
Right.
You're right. But so what's working is when we see management take a step back and really analyze, what do I have today?
Okay.
Because whether they're new or not, in many cases, I ask that question and they look at me once again like I have that, that Labrador looking at me like, what? You know, I mean, they look at me like you got three heads, and I don't, but right. they look at me that way.
Yeah.
So you've seen that a lot.
Right.
And so you've really got to do a very, especially in this day and age when selling, and you made a comment earlier, which I thought was extremely right on, selling in this day and age is radically different than it was just a short time ago, and it will continue to morph.
What's the biggest difference you're seeing in the way in selling between and you know, just a short while ago?
The short while ago is how smart buyers are in most cases.
Okay.
They are extremely smart. They come in, now, I'm not saying they're smarter than the seller, but they come in, first of all, thinking they are smarter than the seller.
And by smart, you mean they're educated as to what's available, what's in the market, probably your track record with
yes.
other customers.
Oh, yeah.
The prices that others have paid.
All of
results
it.
Have been received, all those sorts of things.
And so the buyer, you made the comment earlier, the buyer comes in, they need to understand that. And back in the day, I mean, the long ago day,
yeah.
you know, sellers were the expert.
Right.
Well, I'm not saying they're not now, but the buyer thinks, hey, I know everything he or she does.
I got Google.
Right.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And so a buyer has to come in. Excuse me, a seller must come in very well prepared to go back to the business problem first.
Yeah.
And I see, and that's what works today. When you see a buyer, and sometimes it's not easy to get that business problem out of a buyer for a seller to dig in, but you got to really stick to it and dig in and really understand, why are we looking? Why are you doing this, Mr. or Miss Buyer?
Right.
What is the purpose to this?
And the real skill comes in when the buyer says, Because that's what we've determined we need. Now just show me what you've got.
Yeah.
And how do you get past that objection and that resistance? And it's doable. It's absolutely doable.
It is doable.
But not if, and that's one of the things I have, you know, if you're going to challenge them and be, you get, if you don't have the finesse and the real, communication skills to go with that, it comes across as arrogant or pushy or resistant.
It does.
That doesn't usually get you very far.
But if you don't do that, then you're putting yourself in a transactional kind of situation.
Right.
Oh, you are.
And if you're in that kind of a mode, now you're dealing with price and you're dealing with things that you really don't want to be dealing with if you're a seller.
Right. But that's really where the magic comes in for any kind of training that you're going to go through. It's not just telling you what to do, but how to do it.
Yeah.
And giving you practice. People don't learn skills by a book or by listening. I can read a book on golf. I can hear it, listen to an audio tape on how to play
golf. Watch the Golf Channel 24/7.
24/7. I have not improved my golf game one iota.
Right.
And so it's all about practice. Feedback. If you don't have that feedback loop, and that's what coaching is all about. If you don't have that observational feedback loop to tweak the raw to the more refined and the more refined to the perfect. If you don't have that feedback loop, you don't get better.
No, you don't get better. And I think that's a great point, Steve, is if you don't have that coaching/feedback loop, whatever you'd like to refer to it as, by the way, you've got to do that to get better. This is not one of those things what you can just all of a sudden, as you say, go through a course, sit in a workshop for 2 or 3 days and say, and I've got it now.
Right. I think I've solved the problem.
Oh, yeah.
Now, but I want to get back to a point that you made earlier about these kind of healthy companies that want to stay healthy instead of being kind of reactive to kind of some brokenness somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
Is it make sense then to, if it's important to kind of get the lay of the land and to really assess where you're at and what's going on, to be doing that on a regular rhythm?
Oh, yeah.
Proactively, rather than waiting until some symptom pops up and saying, hey, you know what? We should really fix this thing now. It's broken. I need some sort of training to come into play to fix this problem.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's a great point. And it goes back to what I said about the continuing morphing of the sales process.
Right.
If you're not continually looking at where you are today, I got bad news for you. That hard
tomorrow's
work you did,
coming fast.
It comes in a hurry. And you've got to be looking.
Gradually, then suddenly.
Right.
That's the way it works. And that's the nature of it. And what is your competition doing now that they weren't doing a month ago?
Right.
If you don't understand that, you have a problem on your hands.
So most organizations that I've worked with or worked for have a some sort of strategic planning process, which I get, you know, the word strategy gets so overused.
Oh, yeah.
But they've got a 5-year plan and executives routinely, at least annually, get together to refresh that, to revise it, look at competitive pressure, look at the landscape, where they're taking their business, all of those sorts of things. That should inform your sales strategy. That should inform what your sales force is going to need to do in order to stay current and viable into the future. And if it's not aligned to that, then it's just reaction.
Yep.
So if you believe your strategic plan as a business of what markets you're going to enter, what customers you're going to serve, what products you're going to bring to market, all of those sorts of things, if you honor that, if you believe in that, and you're not connecting your sales approach to that strategy, then there's a huge disconnect.
Oh, yeah.
And then you will be in a situation where you're behind the eight ball and trying to react because all hell's broken loose.
Yeah.
Right. It's one of those things where now I'm just in crisis mode.
Yeah. It's a nonstop crisis mode.
Right.
Because every time something comes up that doesn't fit into what you have gotten in the drawer,
right,
you know, the strategic planning drawer, you go, well, wait a minute, this doesn't fit.
Right.
Oh, boy, what do we do now? What do I do now?
Exactly.
And I've seen that over and over again.
Right.
So I think, Steve, you bring up a great point. It's got to all be aligned. And especially in this day and age when information overload is the rule. It's not an option. It's just a fact.
Well, that's one of the things I do with my clients it's a test I do to see what kind of relationship we've got and what kind of relationship they want. Is I say, well, what's your 5-year plan? And the more transparent they are with sharing that with me, the more I understand that they want me to connect to it. And I've never had anyone, never in all the years I've been doing this, say, why do you want to know? It seems intuitive to them. Now, there's some people who aren't ready to share it yet, and I get that. That's incumbent upon me to develop the level of trust in me that, that will allow them to do
but
that.
But they know it's important.
Yeah.
They get why I want to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Because, and it's not just to, like I said, move in there and stay forever. It's to structure the work I'm doing for and with them to support that.
Right.
And so that's one of the things I think a lot of organizations should do more frequently is make sure that their go-to-market, their sales force, is all structured in an alignment to their overall business strategy.
I agree 1,000%, Stephen. I think one of the coaching points that I make, I will ask sellers, what is the company strategy?
Right.
And it, unfortunately, is astonishing how many times they don't know.
Yeah.
They don't know.
Their own company.
Their own company. Yeah, yeah. They don't know.
Well, if they don't know their own company, how are they going to know what who they're selling to's objectives are?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Sometimes they can ask the customer, but they're afraid to ask their manager.
That is exactly where I was headed. You're right, Steve. So well said.
So they're clear there, but they don't know what their own company wants.
Right.
It's crazy, but that's the reality we live in. It really is.
So that's not an example of a healthy company then, right?
No. Not at all healthy. And, but you know, the nature, what to do. And Steve, I think you guys gave a lot of really good advice to companies who are looking.
So now tell us the right answer.
No, I think a lot of it comes down to that. I mean, and it's not easy. I'm not trying to say this is like something is going to be like, oh, well, I'll take a day and figure. No, this is going to be one of those things where it takes some time to go and analyze where are we really today?
Right.
Not just lip service to it, because I do see companies give lip service to it, but it's easy to tell this isn't real. And you got to not give lip service to it, because if you do, it will come back to bite you.
But if you're
every time.
Right there, then you're going to be wrong. Like, that's foundational.
It is.
Right? If you don't have that right, then whatever you do is not going to work.
Well, yes and no. You're right. However, companies will make it up where it sounds good. And I'm not saying it's right, but it sounds good, therefore they'll go that way. And Steve knows what I'm talking about, because they'll do it. But the good companies, the smart companies, they will basically go, no, we're going to get to the answer. And they work really hard to do it.
You've
got to
find the true north. If you don't.
Well, the best people that I've worked with at the senior levels of an organization will be honest and say, we don't know yet, but we're working on it.
Yeah.
And I don't know is a hugely powerful response.
I know, but people feel like they have to know because they're in charge.
Yeah.
Right. I don't know actually is a credibility building response instead of a credibility killing.
And, I agree 100%.
Too many people misunderstand that.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you very, very much, Steve. And people need to be not afraid to say what you just said to somebody like in your role.
Right.
Because not everyone has all the answers.
Except me. No.
And the answer I had last week may not be the answer today, and that's okay.
All I can say is 42.
So when in doubt.
Right. Hey, Phil, thank you so much for coming in today.
Happy to be here.
Appreciate it. It's been a phenomenal conversation.
Oh,
how do people get in touch with you?
Well, you can reach me via my email, which is pretty simple. It's P as in Paul, S as in Sam, for my first two initials, Bush, just like it sounds, B-U-S-H, @bellsouth.net. Pretty easy. I have the old Bell South email, so I go back a ways.
There you go.
And
it means you have gray hair.
It does mean
seasoned.
I have gray hair. This is true. And, you know, and phone is always good, 404-840-4927. I'm happy to take calls and just talk this through with people.
I appreciate that very much.
Absolutely. Anytime.
And as always, thanks to my partner here, Lee. I appreciate all your time and help.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Great job, Lee.
Thank you both.
I think you guys really hit the nail on the head.
Thanks. Everybody out there, stay cool. It's still a hot one. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to Sales Effectiveness Radio, brought to you by the Semantics Group. To learn more and to listen to more episodes of Sales Effectiveness Radio, please go to semanticsgroup.com.